Good evening. Is there anyone who needs a copy of the worksheet? Just one of each for tonight. Or if you didn't find it, keep it.
We're still searching.
You can keep it.
And we won't give up. It's still working though.
So, some reminders of the context. In our classic lines from Dogen Zenji in the Genjo Koan, those who have great realization of delusion are Buddhas. Those who are greatly deluded about realization are sentient beings. So, this is a class in studying delusion, and which maybe you are quite familiar with, such a concept, but it seems that that's the whole practice is basically not so much imagining ideas about realization, but being very honest with ourselves about where we're at with our misunderstandings and delusion. And also Dogen says in the Genjo Koan, to study the self is to forget the self. We could interpret that as to study our delusions really thoroughly is to see how they no longer hold up and they're naturally forgotten. To study the vivid appearance of a snake in the dark very carefully, we see that it's not a snake and it's just a rope, and therefore we forget the snake. That's one way to look at Dogen's instructions. Also, we had an interesting discussion last week about some of our responses, our immediate reactions to things, whether they're actually based on this view, this the proposal that they're, that even our immediate response of fear, fight or flight, we talked about, response of fear or anger immediately arising, it seems, when the self is threatened, when the person is threatened. And we don't know, but we have these various ideas about, well, is that just a chemical response that doesn't have to do with this view, actually, that it's just a natural part of the wiring of the human system. And I still feel like I'm trying to hold out on this teaching that there is this underlying view of the independent self, misconception or view. It's almost like the word view works maybe if we say we actually, there's a kind of viewing or vision of the body and mind as the self. Like there's part of our mind that views our body and mind as the true me, as a independent, singular, and permanent me. That makes sense? That's a way to use this English word view, which is usually the translation of drishti. This satkaya drishti is the technical Sanskrit term for the view of the independent self. Which is kind of, it doesn't use the word self in it, but that's when the Buddha and the early sutras talked about the view of the independent self, he used this term. but it's like viewing or kind of seeing, part of the mind that's viewing or seeing or has this vision that the body-mind experience is an independent self. So anyway, this point about whether whether these responses are due to this view or not, maybe hard to tell actually how this all works. But in a way, I think the whole point of studying this is not just to like undo a false view just for the sake of truth. I mean, we might say that's a point, one of the points of it. But always it's about helping us be free from suffering and the stress of living with such a view, to be free from pain and suffering, which are the kind of like responses to this. So just, this is a really nice sutra, I think, in the Pali Canon. There's a lot of sutras that are particularly centered around this view of the independent self, but this one's in the middle length discourses, the Madhyama Nikaya number 22, called the water snake simile, which is not the same as the snake simile we've been talking about. And it's a longer sutra of quite a few pages, but there's a lot of great points in it. Thich Nhat Hanh actually has a translation called Maybe the Better Way to Catch a Snake. And it's translated in various places. It's also the sutra where a lot of, you know, wonderful and somewhat unrelated things appear in there. It's a sutra with the famous metaphor of the raft, and when you're done crossing the river on the raft, you can then abandon the raft. You don't have to like carry it up on the shore and carry it on your back. As a metaphor for like, you use these teachings to cross the shore of suffering and be free, and then you don't need to keep like dragging them around. So that and many other teachings are in here. But particularly there's this point now about the self. The Buddha says, I do not envision a clinging to a doctrine of self or a view of self, grasping to which there would not arise sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. So I can't imagine any kind of clinging to a view of self that wouldn't cause these results of sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. And then a little later he says, monks, where there is a self, would there be the thought belonging to myself? Yes, Lord, they say. Or monks, where there is what belongs to self, would there be the thought myself? Yes, Lord. So this is like, wherever there's an I, there's going to be mine, and wherever there's mine, we can find the I. And in fact, the two first verses of Nagarjuna's chapter 18 here are on this point. The first one's on the self that we're really looking at, and the second one's going to say, well, now let's, if we can see through a self, now we can see through mine, which is like ownership of things that belong to a self. Things actually can't belong to a body and mind, right? That wouldn't really make sense, but we feel like things can belong to me. Anyway, he says, monks, where a self or what belongs to self are not pinned down as a truth or reality, then the view position, here's a view he's going to bring up now, this cosmos, this whole universe, is the self. After death, this I, this self, will be constant, permanent, eternal, not subject to change. I will stay like that for an eternity. This is a view that was one of the views kicking around India in the Buddha's time. That after we die, we kind of like merge with the universe, and that is myself. And we do hear teachings like this in Dogen, actually, and Zen, and through Buddhism, through the ages. And we might have that view, even though the Buddha never taught this, that after we die, I, our, you know, our self merges with the cosmos, and therefore that's our eternal, permanent self. And I think this is an interesting part just because I think people in modern times do have this view. It might not be the view of any particular traditional religion exactly. It might be more of a just a kind of modern, maybe new age kind of view. I don't know. And I think even in Buddhism, even in Zen, right, where the teaching is actually not about when you die, you just merge with the cosmos. The classical teaching is that there's a mental continuum of cause and effect, carrying karmic dispositions that continues on in another body, right? Or if one's completely realized the end of all one's karmic fruition, and there's no more karma to have effect, then one's not reborn anymore. Right? That's the classic Buddhist view. But sometimes in our, not just in our, but you know, in Japanese funeral memorial service, like dedications, there's sometimes there's this implication that like, now we're dedicating the marriage to this person, and now they've merged with the ocean of existence, things like this. So even within traditional Zen, they kind of mix in this view that the Buddha is talking about, I would propose. It's subtle, you know. It's like, and it sounds, because it sounds nice, and it's very comforting to a family of someone who's deceased. But the Buddha says here, where there is a self, or what belongs to the self, where those are not pinned down as a truth or reality, then this view of the cosmos is the self, and after death I will be permanent in that way, isn't that utterly and completely a fool's teaching? So he criticizes this view of like becoming one with the universe. And he goes on a little bit more and then says, speaking in this way, teaching in this way, I have been erroneously, vainly, falsely, and unfactually misrepresented or accused. The Buddha was falsely accused by some Brahmins and contemplatives who say, Gotama, the contemplative, is one who misleads. He declares the annihilation, destruction, and extermination of the existing being. So even though that view sounds kind of like an eternalistic view of like the indestructible eternal self, some people criticized him also for saying that the self of the person completely disappears after death, which would be kind of a nihilistic, annihilationistic view of a self. These are these extreme views that people generally fall into. But I think anyway, the point here is not so much the details in this case that I bring it up, is just that that the Buddha says, people misunderstand me, and therefore they falsely accuse me of being like an annihilationist, because I teach no self. That's it. There's another nice sutra here in the early teachings that the Buddha says, I don't actually just teach there is no self, because people would take that as an annihilationist view. But anyway, people misinterpreted him, he says, in this way and criticized him. So then Buddha says, both formerly and now, monks, I declare only suffering and the end of suffering. So this is one of those sutras where he says, I only teach two things, suffering and the end of suffering. Like one of the Buddha's really beautiful, straightforward teachings, right? This is what this whole practice is about. I declare only these two things. And if others insult, abuse, taunt, bother, and harass the Tathagata for that, he feels no hatred, no resentment, no dissatisfaction of heart because of that. So I thought of this part when we were talking about, right? If people are harassing, taunting, and insulting the Tathagata, wouldn't he feel some dissatisfaction of heart? just chemically. But, the Tathagata doesn't feel that. And if others, on the other hand, honor, respect, revere, and venerate the Tathagata for that, or for whatever view or whatever, he feels no joy, no happiness, no elation of heart because of that. So also, he's not moved around by praise and blame, basically, which is where the self gets all shaken up. And if others honor, respect, revere, and venerate the Tathagata for that, he thinks, quote, they do me such service at, basically, the five skandhas of body and mind. He says it in a little tricky way, but it makes clear that basically, because the Tathagata, the Buddha, thinks actually when they're either reviling me or praising me, they're just reviling and praising this body and mind of the moment, not me. So he brings up this very practical application of looking at the five skandhas as all there is at a moment of being either praised or reviled. So there's a straightforward practical application. And then he gives the instruction to the monks. Therefore, monks, if others insult, abuse, taunt, bother, and harass you as well, you need feel no hatred, resentment, dissatisfaction of heart because of that. And if others honor, respect, revere, and venerate you as well, you need not feel joy, gladness, elation of heart because of that. Just think, those people do us such service at, or to these five skandhas that have been comprehended as they really are, as not me or mine. And there's another nice part here. Therefore, monks, continuing in this vein, whatever isn't yours, let go of it. You could say it's the precept of not taking what's not given, you could say, right? If it's not yours, don't hold on to it. Let go of it. You're letting go of it, which I don't know what this is in Pali, but that's our word, right? Just let go. You're letting go of it will be for your long-term welfare and happiness. And what isn't yours that you should let go of? Form. The body isn't yours. Let go of it. Feelings aren't yours. Let go of them. Conceptions are not yours. Let go of them. Mental formations are not yours. Let go of them. Consciousness isn't yours. Let go of it. Your letting go of it will be for your long-term welfare and happiness. So this is the same teaching that Nagarjuna is going to do his own thing with, but it's right there in these early teachings. I thought this is kind of a unique way of saying it. Whatever isn't yours, let go of it. It's kind of saying, well, there's some you. It's kind of, instead of saying, well, there's no such thing as yours, he's saying just, what isn't yours? Well, basically everything you can possibly experience, which is the whole body-mind experience with all its objects of thought and perception also. And then he brings up a metaphor. What do you think? If a person were to gather or burn or do as he likes with the grass, twigs, branches, and leaves here in Jetta's grove, would the thought occur to you, it's us that this person is gathering, burning, or doing with as he likes? Kind of strange. They say, no, of course not, Lord. Why is that? Because those things are not ourself, nor do they belong to ourself. It's just a bunch of twigs and leaves. Even so, monks, whatever isn't yours, let go of it. Your letting go of it will be for your long-term welfare and happiness. And what isn't yours? Form, feeling, perception, formations, consciousness. Kind of comparing the five skandhas to a pile of sticks and leaves, which we don't really identify with. Sweeping them into a pile and burning them, it's like, I don't have a problem. It's not mine. It's a weird example, right? it seems like it'd be quite a stretch to like regard our body and mind as just like a completely impersonal pile of sticks and leaves. And yet something like that is the implication, right? It's not that we shouldn't take care of body and mind, but just the way we identify with them as mind is the issue. Any comments or questions on this part before we go into the next? Yeah.
I look upon the word Tathagata not as an honorific title to the physical Buddha, but as a description of the manifestation of the ultimate in the conventional, which comes and goes. And when it says you need not hold on to fear or gladness or joy, those things are always, they're not the physical sensations. They are always the physical sensations in this or with this or for this or at this. There's always an imputed context for joy or gladness or pain or anger or any of these things.
Imputed context?
Yeah, it's an imputed context. There's an imputed context here that we are in a class.
But particularly we're looking at who's the we.
Well, that's an imputation.
You know, who is it happening to?
When the Tathagata is speaking, this is not a proof text that the Buddha got beyond.
Oh, no, no, yes. Right.
A narratable experience I had that was kind of a really seminal experience. I was this was back in, I don't know, probably 20 years ago. I was chopping onions and thinking of something and watching PBS at the same time, and I had a big chef's knife and I was doing this and at bare feet, and all of a sudden it just flipped out of my hand and fell right down onto my toe.
Mm-hmm.
In that spot, and the pain just shot up my body through my eyes, and I swear that's where I went bald that day. It just sort of and I was in shock. Immediately there came a fusillade of swearing at myself. You stupid SOB. Right now, I was thinking about this week. You know, I just read this thing. And that the assuming inevitability of that which is being cursed at, that has been injured, it just comes up. Now, that's not to say that the pain makes that. The pain is the pain, however that occurs, and it comes and it goes. But there is this impulse that I experience to swear at myself.
Yeah, and not you're not swearing at the hand for being clumsy.
No, it was myself being really clumsy and stupid and careless.
Like your actual identity is flawed because you let the knife go like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's how we think.
There was nobody else in the room except me, and I'm swearing at myself at the top. So I said to myself, you know, as we're doing this, where did that come from? Why didn't I just go, ow, 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 ow? Where did this, you stupid son of a bitch, come from? And so I thought, maybe that's what we're talking about here.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, definitely what we're talking about.
I mean, it's not like I sat back and said, well, I'm not really a scholar of this or that, or, you know, or I guess I was rather careless when I just did that. It was like, bam!
Mm-hmm.
So
self-blame is a really big one.
Somewhere that sense of it was me who was careless, who just hurt himself, just arose almost spontaneously. But I got to say, it happened after the knife hit my foot and this pain rose up through my head.
Mm-hmm.
So, is that what we're talking about, really? A deeply embedded reaction that says, ouch, it's me that hurt, I was stupid.
Yeah, it's not so much the reaction that we're actually looking at, but we're looking at that we feel as if there's somebody other than just the body and mind that's conditioned in the moment, that just naturally we either we got distracted or we didn't even get distracted, but just our hand just working this knife, just something shifted and the knife flew out. That's not me who did that. But then we blame this me that actually can't be found. And so I think we do. I think a really good way to, we've been trying to locate the sense of the independent self. I think self-blame and self-criticism, especially in those extreme cases, like, you stupid idiot. Mm-hmm. You know, it's so absurd when you step back and look at it, because it's like kind of like a self-blaming itself.
And
but that's what we do.
It was so vivid. I went back and I used these questions here. Where was it located? Where was this located? And it was located, honestly, as far away from my toe as it could be. It was like right up here, the top of my head, was shouting at the bottom of my foot, you stupid son of a bitch.
Part of the body blaming another part of the body.
Yeah.
Could be how we do it.
Yeah.
Strange, huh? I found this other little list that I came up with anyway, it was something like some other words that we think of to as the sense of a self, like the controller is one of them. Like there's this body-mind experience that's just happening, but then we feel like there's like a controller of it, like somebody kind of like it's this machine, but then there's somebody, there's a little control tower somewhere up here where there's somebody like pushing the buttons and moving the levers around and like that's in charge. And that's often the one we blame, like, you know, oh, I dropped the knife, like, you up there, the controller, you weren't paying attention. Mm-hmm. Or and it's the one that also, this is just one version, it's not always the controller, but I think one version of the self feels like, to me, like the controller, and it's the one that's like trying to basically make sure that body and mind is like staying in line, you know, and it's the one that, you know, feels like I'm following the precepts or I'm breaking the precepts. The controller, the assessor is another one, like assessing how the body, somebody like outside the body and mind almost feels like, or inside, but that's not the body and mind itself, often feels like assessing the body-mind situation, and or judge, the assessor or judge, like that's the one maybe there to actually happening there, it's like some combination of these that's saying, you stupid idiot, it's like, that's the judge, right? It's like judging body and mind experience, assessing it and judging it, the controller, the assessor, the judge. With another version that's a little different is like the witness. It's like kind of like assessing, but it could even be very neutral. It could even be not all charged up about trying to control, but just witnessing the body-mind experience, but a little bit kind of outside it. Mm-hmm. Or it's body-mind becomes like an objective experience to the witness, which is like, sometimes the witness is used as this kind of like meditation practice, just be the witness, right, of whatever's happening. But in a way, that's kind of like the Buddha usually didn't talk that way, because that would be kind of almost like becoming the self, just like rest as the sense of self. And you could do that in a way that's very like kind of disengaged. In a helpful way, that you watch the body mind doing this thing, but you're just the cool witness. But it's still this kind of like, it's not total. Non-duality, for example, it's like there's some.
That would be the next place we challenge.
The witness.
We challenge the witness.
Yeah, and sometimes actually the witness could be consciousness skanda. Could be the mental consciousness skanda, and I hope today that we'll actually like go through the five skandas now, because this term appears in the first verse, and kind of like pick it apart a little bit. This particular model of what we think where we're looking for the sense of self, because we can say body and mind for short, but it's kind of nice to like go more deeply into like, well, what is this body-mind experience in terms of five aggregates? Yes?
I had a question. Last week you mentioned something, one of the selves that you can think of or consider after death, which gets, I don't know if you use the word passed on, or, and I thought you said number three, inherently existent self, but maybe you didn't.
Oh.
Do you remember something?
Oh yeah, when we're talking about like rebirth, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, we could say actually that that the this conceptually imputed self, number two, as actually what's, you know, conventionally spoken of as what's reborn. You could say, according to actually this Madhyamaka system of Nagarjuna, you say, what's reborn? Well, we know there's no independent self to be reborn. So this is one of the questions that comes up. If there's no self, then what's reborn? Number two kind of works, right? You can say, it exists conventionally. So rebirth is just a conventional thing. Ultimately, there is no rebirth. An ultimate truth, you can't find rebirth. But conventionally speaking, in the world of cause and effect, we can say conventionally, something, it's not exactly a thing, but something conventionally is reborn. But what is that? Well, it's just this aspect of the dependently co-arisen self. It's just a dependently co-arisen imagination, actually, that's reborn. It's a concept in a way. It's an imputation of like the me independence on body and mind. We don't need to, again, remember, we don't need to refute this kind of sense of me, that if we see that it's just a mental imputation, if it's not a actual independently existing self, if it's just a convenient designation using body and mind, you know, the designation arising dependent on body and mind to refer to this collection of body and mind. And it's kind of a strange thing to say that kind of me, we call the mere I, just the mere I, in quotes, that's actually reborn along with, along with, in a way, this, the view of number three. Because there is these, as it says, inherently existent self does not exist at all, but this illusion that it's a little tricky with the wording here, right? Because it says the innate, deeply rooted illusion that the self exists by way of its own character. We couldn't say that illusion is reborn. The conceptually imputed self, along with the illusion that it inherently exists, is reborn. That's why we say it's innate. When we're born with that view. But the actual inherently existent self, that one doesn't exist at all. So when this number three is defined inherently existent self, it does not exist at all. You could say it's to maybe adjust this definition a little bit, how would we say? It's like, it's more than the illusion. It's like, if we're actually talking about the inherently existent self, it doesn't exist. It's like the object of this deeply rooted illusion. Something like that. Can you see how this is a little bit of an issue here? We're talking about the inherently existent self is the product of this false belief. It's believed, in other words, the inherently existent self is believed to be inherently existent, but it's not really inherently existent. But we're just talking about, it's this deeply rooted illusion that the conceptual thing exists by way of its own character. That's what we call the inherently existent self. You could say, maybe we should say, the imagined inherently existent self is what's reborn. Because we can't say the actually inherently existent one, because there isn't one. This might be a little hard to follow. Yes.
Well, I don't want to beat a dead horse, and maybe I just woke up to this conversation. It seems like we're struggling with that word innate, the innate view. How could this little teeny baby... And I think, like last week, we were talking about, you know, kind of our autonomic responses to danger, like heartbeat and breath, and, you know, all those sort of reflexes that really, you know, protect this body. I think, you know, we are born with those, and I think as soon as we start putting it all together, we kind of romanticize, you know, this body that keeps reinforcing itself, that keeps shying away from, you know, the hot stove so we don't get burned, and jumping when you drop the knife. In psychology, there's this idea that, you know, you aren't a unique self, or you don't have that idea until, you know, 1, 2, 3 years. And there's this concept of, you know, the mother, or the shepherding parent, to be non-sexist, is over and over again looking you in the eyes, you know, making you feel like the most special thing on earth. And that's the beginning of self. That this is special. What you said is the romantic view. That this body is something more than just a pile of sticks.
Yeah, or like just like all the other bodies. This one's really special. Sometimes it's defined. That's a quality of
inherent. Because that's an important thing. It's not, you know, our parents, you know, didn't spoil us for good. You know, this idea that we're made to feel special in those first few years really helped us then to go on and come to Zen centers and pay our dues. And
start studying the special self. And I think it's very true that we need it, and sometimes these discussions come up, and I've heard people ask Dharma teachers too, like, well, how can we raise a child to kind of bypass this self-producing thing? And it seems there's universal agreement, like, you can't do that, and it would be very unhealthy to do that. You have to create this healthy sense of self. It's part of the development. Even though, ironically, something like that is kind of what we're deconstructing later on when we're mature. I think if you bypass that, here's another way of talking about it is, this is just a story, but I could imagine that, like I mentioned, this image of like the innate view would be like a computer program that comes with the computer, but it's not activated. Like it used to be that, I know, like Chinese language program was like shrank into this thing, and it comes with Windows, right? But like you can't use it until you go into your fonts thing and kind of like click on that like Asian fonts thing, and then it kind of like opens it up and it like loads on. It's already in there, but it kind of like opens it up so you can use it. And that's kind of how I see this innate view of like this whole system's kind of packed in there in this at birth, I would almost propose that it functions in this very, very subtle way for, this is one idea how it could work for a small baby, but it's not, it can't function in a normal way a cell functions, because it until 1 or 2 years old or whatever, it's not like that program is activated. But because it's there, it does get activated for virtually all sentient beings at a certain time. It's like, otherwise, where would it come from? And we could explain, well, you don't need it beforehand. It comes from, it's just a purely conditioned thing through the mother's gaze and whatever. But just to accord with tradition, this is one way I imagine it could also be, is that there's these basic seeds of delusion, as well as Buddha nature seeds that are innate also. But these two, you know, delusion and total awakening potential is there in every living being from birth. And then either one of them, the delusion ones are going to get activated first, even for a Buddha, it looks like. But then because we have the Buddha potential, you know, in a way, dispositions, those, that's the good news, that's the Buddha nature that all beings have. At least from a certain, maybe Dogen doesn't talk about it quite this way, but that's one way of talking about Buddha nature. And then this thing about the, you know, immediate response on a hot stove, I think something like that, that's very physical, you know, a hand, I think a baby doesn't need to be told about that if they put their hand, the reflex response, physical response. I don't know if we have to have a sense of independent self to do that, but any slight conceptualization about it, like, oh, that hurt me, or like, that's my hand, that's the view. And I think we can have those immediate things, or you can have the shocking, the knife goes into the toe and this shocking wave shoots up the body, but then almost immediately there's this thing of like, I can't believe I did that, and like, and my toe. And I think, so the view is all mixed in with this automatic nervous system thing.
There is. And you know, in the development of the nervous system, learning is actually the kind of programming of latencies. You know, part of that is memory, of course, but the more you go through a neural path, the more likely you are going to go through a neural path, which means the more you know, the less you can learn, because you're more likely to fall into these ruts. So the structure of this experience is inherently delusional, because it's not open to the receipt and interpretation and rendering of all the other energies that lie outside the rut. Mm-hmm. So to some extent, what we're doing when we're practicing Zazen is we're saying, I'm going to compel dendrites out of the rut to pay attention to things that by habit I just wouldn't do. Now over time, this latency, like the mother's gaze, becomes so embedded that we say, that's me and that's her. But it doesn't take away the potential that there is really a kind of a unitary view that was there but for this kind of conditioning. Mm. Now, a child being reared doesn't have the wherewithal to practice that. But I think what Buddha is saying, what our practice is saying, is that when we become aware of this, we can practice in a way that we can make a fuller use of our mind. And at some point, we'll realize we're just at the crest of a wave of consequences, and that even after our notion of ourself dies and goes into the grave, consequences continue. In some sense, we don't know. We can't imagine being conscious for those, but the karma suggests that consequences, cause and effect, don't end.
Yeah, and I think that is a nice way of talking about it. Zazen is just not following the ruts.
Not following the ruts.
Now, I might not go so far as to say dendrites, we're training our dendrites, but as a mind thing, yeah, we're not following ruts, but then we also, a big part of Zazen is just watching the karmic ruts. Like we're not trying to follow them or go with them, but we see we keep falling back into the same ruts in Zazen, right? And that's just studying the self. I think that's just getting, watching how the mind has these tendencies, and we're not forcing out of it either. We're just studying this process and in kind of like in awe of how the mind it works and kind of like is conditioned. We're studying the conditioning of the mind.
But I think of all the things that can never, that's all the things that are least likely to become habituated to is coming here, sitting absolutely still and with intention, not doing anything that humans do. Taking these very simple forms that compel us to challenge the ruts we're in.
Yeah, it's so not the human world, as they sometimes say.
Humans don't survive by doing this.
Yes.
So I was wondering if the view that supports the development of, or the illusion of inherently existent self, is that part of the conceptually imputed self?
Say again, the view.
The view or whatever the ability, the thing that creates the ability to have the thing that's reborn. Mm-hmm. If you're going to be reborn with some idea that you were mm-hmm. and that's an innate thing, mm-hmm. then that has to come from someplace else. Then, you know what I mean? It has to be part of something else that does exist or is something.
Why does it have to come from something that does exist?
Well, how can it be reborn if it doesn't exist?
It doesn't exist in what we mean by inherently. It doesn't exist independently as like an entity. It's just a dependently arisen tendency in the moment, which has no substance. It's just a momentary, fleeting. Like this is the basic teaching of dependent co-arising, is that our experience right now is just it's an appearance of a bunch of stuff arising in the moment, dependent on all these other conditions, why it's called dependent co-arising. And one aspect of the dependent co-arising of each moment for us is this view. It's like there's all kinds of dependent, also we're like seeing colors and hearing sounds, those are all dependently arisen aspects of the whole dependent arising experience. But one of them is this view, and then but it's not, so it exists conventionally. So this is the two truths. Things can exist conventionally, meaning they just arise for one moment and then cease. That's called conventional truth. And then ultimate truth is that actually no thing really exists at all in any inherent way, or nothing exists in and of itself. It's just a fleeting appearance of certain conditions coming together. So you could say that view is like that, actually. It's in a moment, it's a bunch of conditions coming together, and we could even look at what some of the conditions are to create that view in one moment, and then it ceases. And the cessation of that is a condition for the next moment of the view. So they talk about different types of conditions, and one of them is this kind of sequential thing, that the cessation of one moment becomes a condition for the next moment. So there's just this flux of experience that we call me, that's like fluxing along in this inconceivable, ungraspable way. And then at the moment of death, the skandhas of body and mind all start separating, because it's all about the body at this point. It's like not going to function anymore. The heart's stopping. It's the form skandha starts shutting down, and then some other skandhas connected with that too, like feeling physical pain, for example. Physical feeling is also shutting down because the whole physical thing is shutting down. But then you can have this it's a kind of funny way of talking about it, and that's why, and it's so subtle, that's why different schools of Buddhism have all these different ideas of what this very subtle continuum is, something, sometimes what they call it, continuum that's reborn is, because it's not anything that's permanent or continuous. But continuum just means like a series of moments. And in this particular school of Nagarjuna, what they say, it's in a way it's the most subtle view of what would be reborn, and it's just this mere conceptual imputation of I. Not an inherently existent I, but just the conception of somebody, and that's you could say what's holding a conceptual idea in rebirth. You could say, well, it's sometimes that some other schools particularly would say it's connected with consciousness skanda, this momentary arising and cessation of awareness. Actually, the last moment of awareness connected with a body ceases, and then there's a new body, you know, a new conception of a sperm and an egg, and you know, right at that moment, and this is where it gets weird, right? How we would explain this exactly, but at that moment of conception, interestingly that it's called conception, right, in English, a physical conception, that actually a moment of consciousness dependent on the previous moment of consciousness, which was also dependent on a body, that body is no longer connected with that consciousness. So now the consciousness, which is not a thing, it's not an ongoing thing, it's just a moment, but that, you know, this moment ceases and this moment arises, this moment ceases, this is how it's going all day right now as we're speaking, you know, a billion times faster than this, you know, a mind is ceasing, a new mind is arising. The moment of so-called death for a person, it would be like, and right now this thing, this mind thing is totally dependent on the body too, right? And now this thing, like the body, there's a certain moment when the body is no longer connected to a consciousness. Science would agree too, I think. There'd be a certain moment we could find where like it, body no longer supports a consciousness. So we could say that that moment is where the next one of these things suddenly is connected with this new little embryo. You know, the moment of an egg.
I just had a thought which helps me, and I like the way you explain that moment to the next moment, to the next
yeah,
moment.
Yeah, it's no thing and, continuing, just the arising and ceasing.
And then when we stopped breathing, what came to my mind was the universe changes, so maybe that's something like the karma or whatever you want to say about it.
In a way, the whole universe is changing all the time, and at that moment it also changes. And then the classic Buddhist teaching is that there is this unique, you know, stream in quotes, because it's not a continuous stream, but, you know, so-called stream of cause and effect, of moments, with no entity there, but that that cause and effect, you know, it's a unique cause and effect stream, including, and everything else is part of this dependent co-arising too. It's where if you try to map this out or get a hold of it, it's beyond grasping. But yet we can tell these stories that kind of point towards like how there can be a kind of a rebirth without a permanent independent self, according to this teaching. And in fact, if you try to say that, well, with this teaching of no independent self, isn't that more in accord with no rebirth? Wouldn't that be easier to explain? I think it's harder to explain. I think you have a problem with this continuum thing, because also the way karma works, if you have a moment where it just ceases and there's no karmic effect and there's no more, you know, arising consciousness dependent on that moment of cessation of consciousness, then I think we have a problem, because things don't just, it's like the law of conservation of energy, things don't just end. And we could say, well, we just merge into the universe, but that's what the Buddha criticizes here too.
And storehouse consciousness, how does that fit in this?
Yeah, so that's the Yogacara school, right? So Nagarjuna is said to be the founder of the Madhyamaka, or middle way school, and Asanga and Vasubandhu were the founders of the Yogacara school that we studied a few months back. And so that's an example of, in that school, in the Yogacara system, they have a different view. They say, what's reborn there? They say the storehouse consciousness. Alaya Vijnana, this, you know, container of all experiences, which is also not a self and not a thing, but that's
just a different way of conceptualizing.
Yeah, different way. I think it's not that different. Mm-hmm. It's just a different terminology and way of conceptualizing. Because storehouse consciousness is, even it's defined as you might recall, dependent co-arising. But it's the dependent co-arising of a particular person and all their karmic patterns. And the Buddha even said, like, I hesitate to teach this storehouse consciousness because people will take it as an independent self. So remember, in the sutra he says, I don't teach this to children, because they'll just say, that's what I really am. That's me. And he says, not that, but it looks so much like it, I hesitate to even teach it. And in fact, that's why the Madhyamaka school doesn't even bring up storehouse consciousness. They're like, it's just an extra, like, conceptual thing that you don't even need. And some other schools say a subtle continuum of just the fifth skanda, mental consciousness, is what continues carrying, like, you know, in a very subtle way, carrying karmic dispositions, which is the fourth skanda. So these skandas are definitely a way to talk about this life-to-life thing. And, you know, of the five, the physical body is only one of the five, and obviously that doesn't continue from life to life. But it does seem to be that, it seems to me that a consciousness needs a body. You can't have, like, a disembodied consciousness. So this is part of the problem, I think, with, like, the Bardo teachings. You know, the in-between two lives, you can have this 49-day period where there's a consciousness without a body. And again, consciousness is not a thing, but it's a moment-to-moment, this thing going along for 49 days. But without a body? Maybe. The way they talk about it is it's not like our normal consciousness. It's a very, very tenuous, refined, very, very subtle thread of consciousness skanda, but that it can't do things. It doesn't think, you know. It's just enough anyway. But a nice story, you maybe don't need a Bardo. Like, I like the story of where just the very moment of death of one body, that very moment is the, you know, the moment of this cessation of consciousness is the moment of this arising of consciousness in a new moment, you could say. But how would it time itself so exactly? Well, there's billions of beings being born. It's not just humans, right? You can be reborn as animals. So somewhere there's an exact moment of birth at the exact moment of someone else's death. Probably many of them. But anyway, this is kind of metaphysical, so I... and weird.
In a real sense, though, I mean, Siddhartha was a person like us, and he did some things that were sort of like what he used to do, but he did something different somewhere, and he opened up this idea that the consciousness that he is experiencing is distributed.
Distributed,
yeah. That this nature is distributed, and it becomes manifest in particular, and this process that he uses, distributed, we can all do it in a very real sense. Then
I'm not sure what you mean by distributed.
Okay, a hologram is different from a photograph. A photograph negative is not distributed. You have a direct mapping of the image and the negative thing on.
But what is consciousness distributed into? There, as.
It's just a field. You can't say where it is. But the idea of a hologram is that if you apply a certain physic on it, like our skandhas say, the whole image appears no matter where you. What part you use. The whole image appears. All the information is there in all the parts. That's what it means by distributed. In the sense of the way the Alaya consciousness is sort of like distribution, it doesn't become specific until there is something like a body attached to it. But in this sense, we are embodying Buddha consciousness. What we're doing right now, when we're sitting and we're talking, we are embodying Buddha consciousness. We are embodying the distributed potential. We are embodying the very particular techniques that are distributed. By distributed, I mean we all have the ability to do this. If we do not do these sorts of things, we will always appear to ourselves to be independent. If we do these sorts of things, we will recognize that we're not independent. So, in this sense, the Buddha is reborn. Reborn in the sense that Buddha consciousness can only be available to us as we do these things to make it apparent to us. But I don't think what we're doing here is anything different than what the Buddha did, what the Siddhartha did under the tree or in the company of his fellows.
Could be.
Yeah.
And remembering that we're studying our sense of delusion, too. So this is the Dalai Lama saying this point that just I think this is good to keep emphasizing too, that this sense of where we're looking for the self as existent, we're really tuning into that because we're going to look at that. So he says, this realization of how you appear to your mind when you feel falsely accused or whatever, right? When you, that sense of the solid me, this is really necessary, because if you do not get a sense of what inherent existence is, no matter how much you might talk about emptiness, it would be just words. I really appreciate this part, you know, because I think this is where we get into, well, I don't believe in a sense of a self, and like, everything's empty. I've heard that so many times, I think it's really cool. But this is like getting really experiential, right? You have to find this way that yourself appears to be truly existent, because if you don't get a sense of what inherent existence is, even though you might know that you're not going to be able to find it, but this feeling or sense of what inherent existence is, no matter how much you might talk about emptiness, it's just words, it's just fun ideas, and realization of emptiness is just like, yeah, I understand emptiness. But until we feel like, and when we're talking about emptiness of things too, until you really feel like, I really feel like this floor exists in and of itself, you know, it's not just created by my mind, this conception. So now we're just talking about you know, really getting a sense for like, I believe this is here. I think we really have to get into that. And same with our sense of me, to really feel like, I actually, like, it's harder to do than with the floor, right? Because we might feel like, well, it's just a body-mind experience. But like, locating the sense, and we might have to be pushed, and that's, or drop a knife on our toe to feel it. And that's when we're like, oh, okay. This is, now I feel like there's really me here. Otherwise, it's just words. After you've identified this sense that objects exist from power within themselves, it's the sense that objects exist from power within themselves, right? Then the way is open to understand emptiness. You follow that? Like, until we really get a sense for, like, how things seem to exist in and of themselves, we can't really, like, realize emptiness, because it's too abstract. That makes sense?
If we're talking about emptiness as impermanence and interconnectedness,
well,
the experience of that. We've experienced emptiness, are we not?
Okay.
Fully experiencing impermanence and interconnectedness.
It's not exactly interconnectedness. I mean, interconnectedness is like, this was, we had this discussion last class, that dependent co-arising and interconnectedness is kind of like the conventional truth. And emptiness is, you know, if we're being, trying to be really accurate with the words, emptiness is like, actually, things can't be found, which is a little different than things arise.
Well, what I'm saying is, we're experiencing everything changing, and we're experiencing everything changing dependently. That's the experience we have. When we experience impermanence and experience dependent co-arising, that, yes, they're conventional, but they open us to emptiness. Those full experiences open us to emptiness.
Yeah, but what it's saying here is a little bit opposite. Do you catch that? It's saying, get into the delusion. Don't, instead of leaping ahead to, like, we know things are impermanent, dependent, co-arising, let's focus on that part. This is saying, to start with, at this point, really feel the sense that things are not impermanent and they're not dependently arisen. That's what the Dalai Lama is saying. Do you catch that? He's saying, if you do not get a sense of, when you identify, after you've identified the sense that objects do exist from power within themselves, in other words, you get a sense that objects do inherently exist, then the way is open to emptiness. So it's true what you said.
I had to start with the disc. And it changed, and it was dependently polarizing.
But don't you still feel like you're holding it part of a disc?
Holding a piece of plastic.
Yeah, it's, you really think it's a piece of plastic from its own side.
Well, my point is that.
But did you get that point?
Yes, I did. But that's just the next thing. That's what I'm saying.
I want to stop because I think that was dangerous. I appreciate your gestures sometimes, but I think I'd like you to be more careful because I didn't like this coming at my.
I apologize. You're correct.
Okay. Thank you. I'm sorry. I just needed to stop.
Yeah. Okay. I don't have any more discs.
Good.
But there had to be a sense of the disc before the disc transitioned. If one is really experiencing impermanence, one has to experience something as permanent first, and then it's not permanent. You can't expect. I think that's what's being said here. You can't experience impermanence without having permanence.
Really feeling
permanence.
Yeah.
I think that's what's being said here.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't experience dependent co-arising without independent existence.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's what I'm trying to say. That's a very deep process. You can't take it for granted.
Yeah, we can't take it for granted. And also, emptiness is more than just impermanence. We've had that discussion before, too. It's this particular sense that things exist. Like, I mean, this is a good example because it was a moment when the disc ceased, but now I still feel like these are like parts of a CD and that my mind's not just creating them. So that's an example of like, it's impermanent, but it's still, even the pieces seem to exist from their own side. And that's a meditation you can do with the skandhas and the self, because you break up the self and you find it's just these parts, like these shreds of CD, but then it seems like the parts still exist. It's really deep, the sense of inherent existence.
So it gets subtler and subtler and subtler, it just keeps going.
Yeah, but I think the Dogen's thing of like, in this case, we're not leaping ahead and saying, isn't it cool, everything's impermanent and dependent colors, and this is like, let's really get into like feeling our sense of things really exist, especially the self. Here's another little take about this point, I think. And this is Carl Brunholz. In general, when asked, most of us would agree that we're not permanent or completely independent. Right? However, when we're directly reminded of our impermanence in ways we could not ignore, such as getting gray hairs, falling ill, being in a car accident, or facing death, we usually become very upset. Isn't this great? It's a very simple, ordinary example. Likewise, if asked, we would surely say that our left big toe is not our personal self, but when it hurts, we drop a knife on it, or even lose it. We do not at all regard ourselves as separate from this toe. Thus, one very effective meditation on personal identitylessness is to consider how it affects our individual sense of identity to imagine losing, one by one, all our body parts. Yeah, I mean, you can imagine this, right? In addition, we can ask ourselves, at what point in this process of losing our limbs do we still feel like the same person whom we believe we are now in full possession of all our body parts? This could be a homework assignment. If you were somehow able to deconstruct your body and still be conscious, at what point would it be like, okay, this is not me anymore? Where did I just see? It was some TV documentary of, I forget what it was, of somebody wanted to do this experiment of having their head cut off and to see that, or not exactly want to, they were being executed and it was a physicist or biologist, and they said, I want to see if there's still consciousness in the head after death for a certain amount of time. And they said with their friend, you come to my, this is a true story, by the way, in Europe some hundred years ago. They said, you come to my execution with the guillotine, and when my head goes into the bucket, quickly pick up the bucket, and I'm going to blink until I'm no longer conscious, and count, and please record the time. Like one last experiment after I die. Can you imagine? I think this is the spirit of these like inquiries, right? About this. And he did it. Yeah.
He blinked.
He blinked, and it went on for like 10 seconds or something. And so again, is that actually consciousness, or is that actually just like a chicken with its head cut off runs around for a few minutes, right? And they say it's not actually conscious, it's just it's a muscle response.
It's a reflex.
It's a reflex. So yeah, what's the blinking?
Expressed intention before.
Yeah, beforehand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
it's maybe hard to tell.
Yeah.
I think this was on...
Well, the other
hand
blinked.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're about to have 10 heads.
Good example of that.
But here's continuing with this... do we change in our existence as John or Mary when we lose one finger? Or does that take several limbs? Like, probably doesn't take one finger, right? And probably doesn't even take all their limbs. You can have people missing limbs and still they feel like, well, this is me. But what if just our torso and head were left? And when do we cease to exist as a person altogether? The same contemplation can be applied to losing our relatives, our friends, our possessions, and certain features of our mind, as with senility. Such meditations might sound strange, but in practice, they're excellent and powerful tools for learning something about ourselves and our attachments in a personal way that's quite different from mere theoretical speculations about a hypothetical self. At the same time, they also work on our concepts of regarding our body and mind, as well as all other phenomena, as real and distinct entities, such as seeing the collection of many body parts as a single body, taking the diversity of our momentary changing feelings, thoughts, and perceptions to be one mind, or regarding an assemblage of various wooden or metal parts as a chair or a car. Do you follow that? Kind of a meditative, contemplative exercise. You don't have to actually do it, move body parts, but just imagine. And I think this gets into the kind of meditation that Nagarjuna is doing here. Of the body, the body is a concept dependent on its parts. It's a lot of these meditations are on the whole and parts. And so that's where the skandhas and the self are like a whole and its parts. And that's how that reasoning is going to go. Now the skandhas, look a little bit at the five skandhas. They're listed on this chapter 18, the page of chapter 18, examination of the self. At the bottom, they're just defined. So aggregates, skandha is translated as, aggregate, collection, bundle or pile or heap. That's the definition of skandha. But it's body-mind experience. And they're taught by the Buddha. This is just a model. It's not like there really are five skandhas, right? It's just a model to look at our experience. And there's lots of different models. Even the Buddha came up with different models. But this is a really good one, I think, and the Buddha thought. And they're taught in order of gross or like coarse and to subtle. So it starts with form, body or physicality. But interestingly, now this is, Abhidharma, kosher definition of form skandha is the five sense organs and the five sense objects, which is that body? But actually, and this is in terms of our experience, our physical experience is basically five senses and five sense objects. So right there, that includes not only this body, but I think the nice part about this definition of form skandha is it includes the actual whole physical world too, mm-hmm. because it includes colors, sounds, taste, touch. So five skandhas is not just this little body-mind thing. Technically, looking in detail, five skandhas is our entire experience of, the whole world. My personal, each of our personal experience of the whole world is contained in five skandhas. It's like nothing is outside of five skandhas. It's an all-inclusive model. Does that make sense? Eye, ear, nose, tongue, body.
Nothing that appears is outside the five skandhas.
Nothing that appears is outside the five skandhas, yeah. Feeling or sensation. And now they're going to build on these first building blocks of eye, ear, nose, tongue, body. Feeling is the pleasure or pain or neither, three types of feeling. And they're just the basic immediate, it's not an emotion in this case, it's just a basic pain or pleasure, but there is, it is broken down into physical and mental. So you can have a, you know, mental pain, but, you know, an emotion, what we call like sadness, wouldn't be just the second skanda. Sadness is a very complex collection of a whole bunch of different skanda events. In fact, any experience we ever have, all five are operating. You can't single them out exactly, but you can look at like, okay, what's the immediate, every moment, they say, is there's either slightly positive, slightly negative, or just completely neutral feeling, or not slightly, greatly pleasureful, painful. And it's born from, immediately born from the contact of, you know, eye and color, ear and sound. The contact of, in this case, six sense organs, so you can have a mental thought about a mental idea and a feeling, immediate feeling is born, before it's even labeled as such. I think this is a really interesting one, because I would maybe have put that later, but the way it's classified is feeling is like, is like before conception, before you have an idea of it, feeling is there. I think we often think that it would come next, but that's how, I think this comes from, you know, meditative experience, really examining what's happening and being able to catch like an immediate sensation before even, you know, basing it on some story or whatever. And then you have conception. We often say perception. I think conception is a little more accurate because it's a dualistic conceptual, again, very basic, but it's the, it's defined as the apprehension of the signs of sense objects. Signs are like the way we get a hold of things, such as blue, long, short. Enemy and friend is on the classical list, but you'd think that would involve a lot more.
Formation.
Yeah, doesn't it seem like?
Totally.
Yeah, that's a weird one that we might have to think about, because it seems like it's more than just an immediate sensory thing. But I think it's just making the point that it's conceptual. It's quite conceptual, this third skanda, including mental objects. You can have a conception of impermanence or a sense of a self. And in fact, this whole delusion that this whole discussion is about is very much built by this third skanda. It's like, now one story is that it's a view that resides in this huge collection of the fourth skanda, but it's like it's made conscious through this concept. And concept can be even before an actual word, but it's connected with words, though, too. But the immediate conceptual grasp, it's the way that we grasp things as things.
I wonder if the friend-enemy is kind of like that pre-conceptual for and against that isn't based on thought. You know, how there's this immediate...
Pre-conceptual for and against. Yeah, mm-hmm, yeah.
There's this
based on feeling.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
That... You
mm-hmm.
go towards or you
yeah.
go away from.
Yeah, and that's how you can see that you have form, you have an immediate feeling of, you know, pleasure or pain, and then the conception kind of grasps onto that as something to pleasureful. It kind of labels it as pleasure and pain. The feeling is before it's even labeled as such. And then the karmic formations or fabrications, karmic tendencies, habits. In the early... when the Buddha first came up with it, he basically defined it as intention. And then later, all these other mental qualities like greed, hate, delusion, pride, views, doubts, laziness, diligence, all these mental qualities all get just heaped into the fourth skanda. It's like the storage container. In a way, I think the fourth skanda is what evolved into Alaya Vijnana, the storehouse consciousness, because it just contains all these. But interestingly, the early teachings, it's just intention. And I think because intention is one of the, even in all these big lists, it's always on the list of, and intention is this mental quality in the fourth skanda, and I think it's the main one. And for purposes of locating a self, I think it's one of the main ways we identify with the self is like my free will. You know, my being able to choose things, that feels like me. I see it's just about time to stop here. to mention the last consciousness, is the basic awareness or knowing. It says non-discriminating illumination. I would say it's actually subtly discriminating, but it's not discriminating like conception does. Again, of objects associated with the six sense organs. So if you read through these definitions carefully, you can see how each builds on another. So we can have just a basic example of all five in a row. Would be knife hits the toe. It's like form. It's like the fifth sense of body and touch. And a touch object hits the toe. That's form. Form and body and touch, mm-hmm. contact. At that contact, there's immediately a feeling of pain or pleasure. Mm-hmm. In this case, it's pain. And then immediately following that would be the conception of like knife and toe, pain, and this is pain and it's no good. Mm-hmm. This is all very quick, right? And then the fourth skandha kicks in of like, you know, not even this, the words you stupid idiot, but like, just like the aversion of like, you know, anger and aversion and resistance to the pain. Mm-hmm. But you need a conception in order to do that. And then the actual responses are starting to come out of like, mm-hmm. how could you have done that? The self view is getting all activated. And meanwhile, the fifth one, consciousness, is just the awareness of the whole process.
Yeah.
Almost like the witness.
Yeah.
It's just like, oh, kind of neutral. So zazen, you could say, is really resting in, at least the basic zazen of calm abiding zazen would be like just resting in the sixth consciousness. It's just like aware of all the other stuff that's happening in the five skandhas in this neutral kind of way. It's still not Buddha mind, but this is like basic meditation practice.
I was thinking beyond these the breaking of the as an exercise,
mm-hmm.
to run the five skandhas through there.
You can do it, yeah.
Yeah.
It's an immediate sensory thing. There's a feeling of like shock and like, this is not very pleasant. and then the conception of like we were able to recognize it, but it was so unexpected the kind of like it was so out of my usual experience that it took a while to label it like, oh, a CD just exploded.
Yeah.
And then like kind of like some aversion, like that's kind of extreme and maybe dangerous shards. And then meanwhile, there's this awareness that's just like the zazen mind's just like, oh, that happened. Mm-hmm. See, so maybe this is a nice homework thing is you can like just start watching, read the definitions again, start watching, see if you can like locate a sense of the five, each of the five skandhas, which they're all operating basically all the time. And you can't really pick them out, but you can see how they work together. And particularly, you can start to look how you start identifying the sense of self with any one of the five. Often it's the combination of all five, but sometimes it's just the body, sometimes it's just a feeling, and so on. So, may all beings study their delusion completely, thoroughly, and thus be Buddha. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.